Welcome to the Climate Diplomacy Podcast, a podcast from Adelphi, bringing you the latest insights and debates in international climate diplomacy. We are your hosts, Raquel Monayat and Hanna Kuonut. In this series, you will hear from leading experts offering their take on what needs to be done to promote climate foreign policy and provide you with the context you need to understand climate diplomacy today. For more information, please visit climate-diplomacy.org or follow us on Twitter under Climate Diplo.
In this episode, we will speak about climate fragility risks in South Asia, together with Dhanasri Jayaram, author of the Climate Fragility Risk Brief on South Asia. She is assistant professor at the Center for Climate Studies of Manipal Academy of Higher Education in India, and is also a member of the Climate Security Expert Network. Dhanasri's work focuses on climate diplomacy, climate security with a focus on the military, and geoengineering. Before we start, we would like to apologize for any small audio disruptions due to remote recording.
Welcome, Dhanasri. Great to have you as our guest for today's episode.
Hi, Raquel. Thank you so much for having me on the podcast.
So we'd like to start by giving our listeners a quick overview of the region. So what can you tell us about South Asia that is relevant for understanding the risks that climate change brings to it? And are there any characteristics or dynamics that are particular to the region?
So South Asia consists of 8 countries. If you typically use the South Asian Association for Regional Cooperation as the model for including countries like Afghanistan, Pakistan, Nepal, Bhutan, India, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, and Maldives. So all these countries are in a way physically very vulnerable to environmental change and climate change in general. And there are a lot of physical vulnerabilities that emanate out of the fact that you have long coastlines, you have the Hindu Kush Himalaya region, which is like also called the third pole because of the glaciers and everything. You have a number of rivers in the region, you have deserts. So you have different types of topography in the entire region, which makes it highly vulnerable to environmental change. But other than that, to understand risks associated with climate security, it's also important to understand the demographic, the socio-political, the cultural, the economic landscape of the region itself. So in that sense, it's very important to remember that this region is constituted by countries that are from middle income to lower middle income range. You have fast-growing economies like India. Bangladesh has also shown high rates of GDP growth in recent years. But of course, with the COVID-19 situation, has changed with the economy really showing a sluggish pace of growth. Low human development index is also something that is pervasive in this region. And apart from that, it's also important to remember that you have marginalized communities like women whose status and role in the society is not up to the mark. So we have also indigenous populations, which are also at risk of being affected by climate change and associated economic and social disruptions in the future.
Thank you for this explanation. And now that we know a bit more about the dynamics at play in South Asia, let's look at how climate change plays into this picture. So in your risk brief, you've identified 4 climate-related risks to security for the region. Could you walk us through them?
Yeah. So in my risk brief, I have basically talked about 4 pathways in which climate change can affect the security dynamics in the region. And to start with, what I have spoken about is the regional tensions that may increase, especially because already there are existing tensions between countries like India and Pakistan. There are geopolitical rivalries. We have to take China also into consideration because most of the rivers that flow in South Asia originate in China. So we also have to take into consideration the fact that we have had recent border conflicts between India and China as well. So regional tensions, especially over resources, is something that needs to be taken into consideration. Secondly, the second pathway that I have looked at is how climate change affects livelihoods, human health, for instance. And livelihoods is a huge part of the debate here. And why I'm saying that is because all these countries are also largely agrarian in nature. And with agricultural sector being a large contributor to employment and food security, of the region, with and climate change affecting agricultural produce. And we also have to remember that the region is also undergoing a sort of agrarian distress, irrespective of climate change, right? So in that sense, climate change actually aggravates the problems faced by some of these sectors. So that can also lead to livelihood insecurity and human insecurity, which is already the case in a lot of parts of the region. The third pathway that I have identified is migration. And now this is an issue that is not well studied, unfortunately, in the region. And I'm seeing a lot more studies coming up in recent times. However, there is very little understanding of how climate change affects demographic and migratory patterns. So already you can see that there is a lot of migration happening from the coastal areas to interior areas, from rural to urban areas. However, we have also seen that there are trends, in fact, which show interstate migration also that is being affected by climate change, especially along the Indo-Bangladesh border and Indo-Nepal border. These are some of the issues which can also sort of affect the conflict dynamic. We also have to remember that some of these countries, they may be politically stable right now with elections and governments in place and all of that. But we also have to keep in mind that some of these countries have emerged out of civil wars. There are still ethnic tensions between communities, like in the case of Sri Lanka. In these cases, of course, some of these infragilities actually compound with climate change acting as a risk multiplier in itself. The other pathway that I have looked at is how some of these factors can also lead to increased maybe crime rates, or how it can also help some of the extremist organizations recruit people who lose livelihoods. Now, there have been instances in the past where disasters, for instance, have been used or exploited by extremist and terrorist organizations to recruit more people and to also engage with the public to gain legitimacy among the public itself. Like when floods happened in Pakistan or when the Indian Ocean tsunami happened, we have seen examples of how groups like Lashkar-e-Taiba have used this opportunity to gain more legitimacy among the public. So in that sense, if the government is not able to provide all the necessary amenities and relief and rescue and rehabilitation to the people, and if such organizations step in, what kind of a situation would that lead into? And I think it's also important to remember that in many cases, especially when populations are forced to move into, say, relief camps in particular, there are cases where women are subjected to physical violence or sexual violence. So again, these are some of the things that we have to also keep in mind as we talk about climate change from the perspective of risks at multiple levels. Although not much has changed, however, I would like to add the fact that with the COVID-19 pandemic, we know that the situation has changed a lot as far as the linkages that you can bring in between public health, human health, climate change, environmental disruptions. And we have seen the kind of effects that are being seen across the region. So when the recent cyclone happened along the western coast of India, Cyclone Tauktae, when it hit the western coast of India, around the same time, we also had the second wave of coronavirus pandemic, which hit the country in a very, very bad way. With both these different disasters happening at the same time, we saw that energy security was affected because a lot of electricity grids were destroyed by the cyclone. And with that, the oxygen cylinders that were much needed to keep the patients alive could not be provided to the patients at the right time, which also affected the delivery of health services. So this shows the kind of problems that we're looking at in the 21st century, wherein multiple disasters are affecting human welfare in a big way. And this should be the security concern that we should all be worried about. And this is a lesson that we need to learn from at least the pandemic and so many things happening at the same time, which we need to take care of in the future.
That's a good point here. Risk Brief came out in November 2019, so right before the storm hit us. And I think on the climate risk side, probably nothing has changed, but we have this added risk now. And it's good to have an overview of the risks that climates pose, and now we can work with these and add to that the risks the pandemic bring. Thank you so much for that.
Sorry. One more thing that you probably want to add. I just wanted to stick to that 5 entry points. But I think one of the entry points definitely is in terms of the green recovery that we are all talking about. today, but that kind of depends on finances. Yeah, you know, so that is a huge problem right now, and nobody has the money. So I think this is where, again, security narratives can definitely shift towards a more inclusive approach, where we talk about a more sustainable future for ourselves. And if we are to do that, if we are to recover in a manner which is going to include a holistic concept or idea of security, that needs to kind of be spurred at this moment rather than waiting for another 10 years.
That's very interesting. I haven't thought about all those things before. And I think it's very important that we discuss them today. And I guess it isn't surprising that in a region with a very large rural population and where farming is so crucial to livelihoods, climate change is an imminent threat. But I'm also interested to know more about the conflict risks, as I think these aren't normally associated with South Asia, and at least not in relation to climate. So can you tell us a bit more about climate and conflict in the region? And would you say climate change is just a further stressor that exacerbates risks, or does it play a more central role in conflicts than we commonly assume?
As far as I see the linkage between climate change and conflict in the South Asian region, so you're absolutely right when you say that there hasn't been much work done on linking climate change to conflict in the South Asian region. So we don't have enough empirical evidence to show that, yes, climate change is a major factor that contributes to conflict or exacerbates conflict in any way. But definitely, you can already see that climate change is adding to the existing pressures. So we have a region where poverty is still not completely resolved. We still have income inequality, and we still have marginalized peoples whose rights have been deprived for a really long period of time, including women and tribal population. So in that sense, there is that sense of insecurity which comes out of, you know, even including the fact that natural resource management has not been done properly at the sub-state level. But as I mentioned, there are already existing conflicts. So this is something that I work on personally as well. Like when you take the example of the Hindu Kush Himalaya region, which is a highly ecologically fragile area in terms of climate change, as well as other forms of environmental degradation. At the same time, it is also one of the most militarized regions of the world as well, with India, China, Pakistan, as well as now you see increasing tensions between India and Nepal as well over territorial issues. So with territorial issues sort of gaining that preeminence over ecological cooperation, what is happening is that climate change may add to the geopolitical fault lines that already exist. And there are already some signs of that. You can see how military strategies and operations are being affected by climate change. Take the example of the Siachen Glacier, which is the highest battleground in the world, where you have Indian and Pakistani soldiers who are deployed on both sides of the border. And this is one of the coldest areas in the world, where the Siachen Glacier seems to be receding at a fast pace. Now, how does that really affect the military positioning or deployment of both these countries? So there are a lot of examples like these, and including now with India and China also having problems over the borders. It's been happening for a long time, but in recent times with the border clashes, it has come to the limelight more. So with these examples, and with the examples especially of river water sharing, which may get affected by lowering water levels, for instance, with the glacier retreat happening, how does that affect the flow of water? How does that affect the quality of water? You can already see conflicts between communities within a country. It may not happen between countries so far, but within the country itself, you can see there are conflicts between consumers, conflicts between different communities, which is happening. So in that sense, climate change can add to the existing stresses that the region is already facing. Another example I can give is how the Rohingya refugee issue has become such a huge issue in Bangladesh. So not many people know about this, but then it was in the news that there were a lot of local population, local people in the Cox's Bazar area where the Rohingya refugees are housed. They started voicing dissent against the fact that Rohingya refugees were taking up most of the arable land. It was leading to more deforestation in that area. So suddenly, the feeling that the local population over there was not getting enough access to resources. So this kind of tensions between communities over resources. I mean, although Rohingya issue is not something that is linked to climate change, but indirectly with, say, also Cox's Bazar is also one of the most climate vulnerable areas, where it is always hit by cyclones, floods. There are other environmental problems over there as well. So it kind of becomes a compounding factor at the end. So with the resource access becoming an issue, the tensions between the local population and the Rohingya community started to emerge in recent times. And with that, of course, we also saw how the Bangladesh government decided to take out a large proportion of the refugees to a remote island in the Bay of Bengal region. Now, this is the kind of ethical dilemma that may come up more and more, especially with a lot of people moving from, say, rural areas to urban areas, and urban areas being stressed already, and with a lot of population moving in, resource crunch is going to be a problem. Disaster management is going to be a problem. This may create tensions between communities. And as I mentioned, at a macro level, obviously, as I mentioned, tensions between countries can also be influenced by climate change.
And beyond the role of climate change as a stressor, do you think there is potential to utilize climate action and climate adaptation measures as peace-building tools in these conflict contexts?
I think it's absolutely possible to use them as peace-building tools. Why I say that is because these are the kind of problems that cannot be resolved by just one country. So when you have a transboundary river basin, you cannot really divide that into two countries with a line and say that, okay, you manage that part of the river and I manage this part of the river. It doesn't work that way because climate change is affecting the whole basin. It's also affecting groundwater levels, for instance. So aquifers cannot be divided by political boundaries. These are all interconnected. And in fact, with countries like India and Pakistan, there is obviously a lot of opportunity to engage in peace building through joint river basin management, for instance. And we have an Indus Waters Treaty, which is already called a successful treaty since the two countries have never gone to war over the Indus basin itself. However, effective cooperation has not really taken place between the countries. So in that sense, is there a way of advancing cooperation between the countries and enhance trust and some sort of, you know, mutual understanding on how to really manage this river jointly, and rather than just doing it in their own respective territories? And that becomes a tool for peace building itself, because that will bring the communities together, that will bring the scientists together, maybe to think of how really to go about this, that will bring the policymakers also to talk about these issues at greater length. Similarly, I think there is a great scope for cooperation between India and Bangladesh over the Ganges, between India and Nepal as well. So right now, because of the geopolitical sort of the tensions that exist between these countries, cooperation is not really taking place. So maybe there is a possibility that you could take water as that tool for enhancing even political relationships between the various countries in the region. And I think here it's also important to point out that I have read some of the recent articles, especially the one that came out in International Affairs, and it was very interesting to read how grassroots mobilizations also can enhance environmental peace building between different countries of South Asia. So for instance, Sundarbans is a region that is shared by both India and Bangladesh. So at the top level, at the government level, yes, a memorandum of understanding has been signed, but because of the lack of political will and institutional capacity, it hasn't really taken off really well. However, you have a lot of communities on the ground who are already working with each other. So that may also enhance trust and peace building between countries to avoid any sort of conflict over climate-related disasters or climate-related resource stress. So that is very important. Similarly, on the India-Pakistan border as well, you can see Thar Desert, which is also a shared geographic entity. Again, this area is facing desertification, soil erosion. There are a lot of problems already that are being faced in this part of the region as well. So there is possibility of enhancing cooperation between the grassroots organization to avoid climate change from deteriorating any further.
Now looking into the future, on the climate change side, we know that things are bound to get worse. At the same time, several governments in the region, like India, Bangladesh, and Nepal, are actually quite involved in the climate conversation and have been incorporating climate policies into their national strategies. Can you give us a glimpse of what is going well and where regional governments are still lagging behind in regards to building climate action into national policy agendas?
Yes, as you said, all the countries in the region have their own national level action plans and strategies on climate change. And it has been in place, especially since the 2000s, when the effects of climate change compounded a lot more and when the countries realized that they need to get their act together to do something about this. Now, of course, some countries prioritize adaptation, some others prioritize mitigation. It is also a fact that most of the countries also lack financial resources to put these actions into complete implementation or to sustain them over a longer period of time. Nationally, there are a lot of institutions and policies that have been put in place. All the countries have their own national level plans. Regionally also, if you look at it, you have various regional organizations like SAARC, South Asian Association for Regional Cooperation, BIMSTEC, which is a Bay of Bengal-based organization. You have BBIN, which is a Bangladesh, Bhutan, India, Nepal initiative. You have IORA, which is an Indian Ocean Region Association. So you have all these different regional organizations which have all integrated climate change into their agenda. However, the level of effectiveness of these organizations is something that we need to look at because they're not very efficient when it comes to implementing some of these action plans. So SAARC has an action plan on climate change, but because of the geopolitical rivalries between India and Pakistan, SAARC has not really functioned well in the past few years. In fact, after 2014, the annual summits have not happened. We had one virtual summit last year because of COVID-19, but that's it. So that's one of the limitations of all these regional organizations is the fact that how do you make them more effective to make sure that climate change plans that they have already set up actually work in the region. So that is important at the regional level. At the national level, like I mentioned, the problem lies with the fact that financial resources are lacking. So some of the countries like Bangladesh, Maldives are very, very serious about acting on climate change. They have raised the issue of climate change on multiple international platforms. But the problem lies in the fact that there is not enough financial resources to sustain their agenda for a long time. Similarly, institutional capacity is another factor that we need to look at. At the same time, these countries are also trying to enhance the capacities of local organizations, local authorities, local governments, which is equally important when you talk about climate-related security risks, because essentially the security risks that would be faced by people in the region will be very context-specific, will be specific to certain regions. So the kind of risks associated with climate change in the Himalayan region would be different from those living along the coastal areas or along the delta regions. So therefore, it is also important to enhance the capacity of the local organizations and authorities and governments to see how to act on climate change in the future. So these are some of the limitations. However, I think incrementally, a lot of policies and institutions have been built over a period of time, which is a good sign.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And it's also a great bridge to talk about the entry points for action. So in your risk brief, you've identified also 5 entry points for addressing these climate-related risks, a few of which you already touched upon some of the policy issues that you just mentioned. But looking at the policy directions that we can observe in the region on the one hand, and also at the entry points for action that you've identified on the other hand, do you see any major gaps that require immediate attention by local governments?
Yeah, as I already mentioned in my previous answer as well, I think there are a lot of gaps when it comes to understanding climate security risks itself. So just the fact that there's not enough knowledge in this area is a huge problem in overcoming this particular limitation. And I think that is changing to some extent because I see that a lot of institutions are now working on climate security risks in the Bay of Bengal region, in the Himalayan region, the Hindu Kush Himalaya region. Then I also saw that a project is running which concerns maritime security and climate change. So in a way, climate change is slowly finding its place into the security arena, but it is not happening at the pace it should, considering the urgency of the problem itself. So as far as the entry points are concerned, I think the first and foremost issue here is about, as I mentioned, regional cooperation itself. And to enhance that regional cooperation is very important because there are a lot of common problems and common issues, and there are a lot of transboundary issues. So it is imperative for the countries of the region to come together and address these issues in a very concerted manner. In that respect, transboundary river cooperation is the first and foremost priority that should be kept in mind. And we can see that how much of destruction is being caused by even river flooding. And unless the two countries or more countries which share the basin cooperate, some of these issues cannot be addressed efficiently. The other area in which there is entry point for cooperation is adaptation and disaster risk reduction. This is an area where we already have some level of cooperation, especially through the regional organizations, which I mentioned earlier. But there is a lot to be done more, because we can see that the intensity and frequency of cyclones, for instance, has risen in recent years. We can see cyclones, for instance, coming up in the Arabian Sea, which didn't see cyclones in the past. And now we can see that every year there is at least one or two cyclones, even in that region, because of the sea surface temperatures rising. This disaster risk reduction is definitely one of the areas which needs to be focused upon. And because India has already sort of launched this coalition of disaster resilient infrastructure, that could possibly be one of the ways in which the countries of the region can come together. Adaptation, unfortunately, has not been looked into much. So adaptation still receives a lot more attention, particularly in terms of finances. And I feel this has a lot to do with the global climate environment as well, where the larger part of the finances are usually allocated to mitigation. However, the South Asian countries desperately need more money for adaptation and resilience building. So in that sense, again, the countries need to come together to address this concern, especially when it comes to countries like Nepal and Sri Lanka, which faced civil wars just a few years ago. As much as mitigation, adaptation has to be focused upon. And then human mobility is another factor. So I think migration has not been addressed much, even at the interstate level. Intrastate level, there is a lot more happening now. So I know that in India, Bangladesh, at least the government itself is stepping in to make sure that people are moved from the vulnerable areas, the coastal areas, and into less vulnerable areas. However, there also you need to bear in mind the fact that when you do the relocation, when you take the people, uproot people from their cultural habitats, and when you uproot their livelihoods and then you move them to another region, how do you really rehabilitate them? And that makes a huge difference to even security risks as well when it comes to livelihoods and human security. I think there is an entry point there for addressing interstate migration also, which has not been addressed because of political reasons once again. So, for instance, when you take the migration from Bangladesh to India, normally you call it like illegal immigration. So that's the term that you commonly associate with it. And now that's again a problem, because when you already sort of call it illegal, it becomes difficult for you to address it through legal means. So you need to bring in more policy or legal mechanisms to make sure that people who are displaced owing to climate-related disasters have to be safeguarded in some way or the other. So South Asia as such doesn't have much of a policy on migration related to climate change, either nationally or regionally. And this is a huge gap that needs to be bridged. And possibly talking about rural to urban migration, etc., it's possible that at least talk about, you know, city networks, which can help sharing knowledge and sharing best practices about how to really manage human mobility in that sense. Last but not the least, it's also important to look at actionable information on how climate change affects extremist movements, or how does it exactly lead to further problems for security agencies itself. And I think this is something, again, it's a dark spot there, because I don't think the security agencies necessarily take climate change into consideration. I mean, yet I see that there is a greater level of engagement with these issues, but I think that won't be enough as we look at further changes in the future.
And we've been asking about South Asia all this time. It was also the focus of your risk brief. But the region is, of course, not homogenous, and not all governments are equally involved or even interested in a climate issue. You've made that clear already with many examples. Would you say that there are specific actors in the region that are holding progress back? Or perhaps, to frame it more positively, who would you say is setting a good example? You've mentioned already the Maldives and Bangladesh, but perhaps there are more aspects worth highlighting here.
Definitely. there are differing perceptions over climate security in the region. So some countries overtly acknowledge the security implications of climate change, and that includes countries like Bangladesh and Maldives. However, if you look at their internal policies, there's not much of that overt security linkages that are there. However, at the international level, they do talk about security implications of climate change. At the same time, you have countries like India, which does not like to internationally speak about climate security, doesn't acknowledge the security implications of climate change. Internally, yes, it's kind of changing. The mood is changing slightly, especially with some actors realizing that this has implications for security at multiple levels. And that includes the military, for instance, which has been looking into operational effectiveness and other things, which of course gets affected by climate change no matter what. So in that sense, it's changing. But to get all the countries to cooperate on climate security, it's not just contingent on these perceptions alone. It is also contingent on the available resources, the available knowledge, and also the political will to cooperate with each other, which is lacking as of now. So I think all these factors play into the lack of effective coordination on climate security risks. Despite the fact that you have so many eco-geographical areas that are transboundary, yet there's no joint effort being made by countries to study the impacts of climate change and understand how it interacts with the social, economic, and security aspects in a joint manner. So yes, perceptions, resources, and the fact that regional institutions are not really working well, they all play into the fact that it hasn't really moved much in a positive direction so far.
I have a question to you regarding India. So about a year ago, when India was elected for a UN Security Council membership for 2021 to 2022, you wrote an opinion piece for the Climate Diplomacy Platform about the country's cautionary approach regarding climate security, neither being fiercely against nor in favor of bringing in climate change as a security issue to be dealt with by the Council. 6 months into their membership and a few debates on climate security later, would you say India is still maintaining this warm approach, or did anything change since then?
Yeah, so that I don't think has changed much. For a long period of time, since 2007, when the issue was introduced in the Security Council for the first time, India has used a very cautionary approach. I think it has moved from complete opposition to a sort of caution now. So, you know, initially it was rather more conservative approach there. And I think this continues till date, where India feels that security approach is not the right way to deal with climate change, because it may lead to militarized solutions and it may lead to solutions that are contradictory to the principles of common but differentiated responsibility and respective capabilities and climate justice, equity. Now, these are the principles based on which India would like climate change to be addressed. However, the security approach, according to the Indian policymakers, would essentially question these principles, which is not acceptable to them as far as the Security Council's role itself is concerned. Of course, the fact that there are geopolitical connotations attached to the Security Council itself, which is something that the Indian policymakers have raised time and again, that an unrepresentative organization like the UN Security Council cannot deal with climate change because this is a global issue and needs to be dealt with in an organization that is representative of all the countries. So this is something that the Indian community has been reiterating. However, like I mentioned, internally, things are changing. You can see that there is greater level of interest, at least in understanding the security dynamics. Like recently, I have seen that some of the think tanks and research institutes are looking into the security dynamics, especially the military is also taking interest as well. So I think these kind of changes, and especially at the policy level also, when there is greater recognition of the risks at a security level, it may change the perception also. But I think the problem here is the fact that principles like responsibility to protect, or maybe something that can promote sanctions, these are the kind of rules or principles that the Indian government as of now would be opposed to as far as climate change and UN Security Council is concerned. And the idea is to promote climate action only under the umbrella of the UNFCCC, which should be the apex body to govern climate action and not a body like Security Council.
Danazri, that was great. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today about climate security and also climate diplomacy in South Asia. Let's summarize for our listeners maybe what we talked about. You identified four pathways that link climate change to insecurity and conflict in South Asia. First, escalation of regional tensions due to competition over resources. Second, worsening economic and livelihood insecurity. Third, increased migration movements and rapid urbanization linked to slow and rapid onset disasters. And fourth, compounding risks of crime, extremism, and terrorism. You also explained that at present, there are no dedicated frameworks that directly address climate fragility risks or the security implications of climate change in South Asia. We spoke about climate action and climate adaptation measures as a peace-building tool, and you highlighted that conflicts can't be resolved by one country alone. You explained the example of India and Pakistan and how they could engage in peace-building through joint river management, and this would also advance cooperation and enhance trust and help to manage resources more effectively. Regarding climate action in national policy agendas, you described that various organizations and institutions are including the topic into national and regional strategies, but that the level of effectiveness is questionable. At the national level, you highlighted lacking financial resources. One other important thing when speaking about climate-related security risks is their context specificity. We must enhance local capacities to act upon risks compounded and posed by climate change.
Furthermore, you suggested the following five entry points for addressing climate fragility risks: facilitate and strengthen the regional cooperation, enable and bolster transboundary river basin cooperation, support adaptation and disaster risk reduction efforts to secure livelihoods, manage human mobility and urbanization, and understand and prevent violence, extremism, and terrorism. Finally, we've discussed India's behavior in the UN Security Council, and it's not necessarily oppositional, but rather a cautionary approach towards climate security in the body, voicing concerns regarding militarization, geopolitical implications, but also issues related to representation. Danazri, thank you so much for joining us today. We will be back with another episode of the Climate Diplomacy Podcast in a few weeks. Our listeners can reach us with questions and feedback on Twitter at Climate Diplo. Thank you for tuning in. And until next time, goodbye.
Goodbye, everyone. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, bye.
Bye.